if it's something you want and you can afford it, you're going to get it whichever way you can. And if you can't get it through the boutique, you can't get it through regular retail channels, you can only get it at auction, and you don't really care about whether or not you're paying two or three times retail, then, you know, you just do what you have to do. I think that it speaks to the sort of degree of disposable income that people are increasingly willing to throw at, I think, collecting in general, certainly during the pandemic, and watches in particular.
Hey everybody, I'm your host Stephen Pulverin, and this is Hodinkee Radio. If we go back to early 2020, when the pandemic kind of changed the state of the world, there's one question I get from people in the Hodinkee community more than any other, and that's, how's the watch market doing through all of this? Now, there's no single answer that covers the whole watch world. Plenty of sectors are struggling, plenty of sectors are doing better than ever, but you know what's definitely not struggling? The auction market. And I wanted to get Cole and Jack on mic with me to cover the sales from Hong Kong, Geneva, and New York this spring to try to get a sense of what the market actually looks like. So we'll talk about everything from the new record setters to the brands that are experiencing surges to where you can still find value if you're trying to do that at a watch auction. But that's not everything. There was one late-breaking sale. It came just this past Saturday morning in the U.S. It was actually an evening sale at Christie's Hong Kong. And this was the Legends of Time sale. It was just 18 lots, all super high-end. And one of them was the legendary Alan Bamberry Patek Philippe 3448 Senzaluna. So just an hour or two after the hammer fell on that sale, John and I hopped on the mic to try to parse the results. And I gotta say, it's not that simple. They're not so clear cut. So you definitely want to stick around to the end of this episode to hear that conversation too. So with that in mind, today is all things auction. And without further ado, let's do this. Hey guys, how's it going?
It's going great. Going absolutely great.
Going okay, Stephen. How's it going with you?
It's good, man. It's good. It's been busy at our dispersed Hodinkee HQ. I guess there is no HQ right now, but you know, we're in three different cities, three different time zones, and we're talking about watches. I mean, life's pretty good.
Yeah, between the three of us, we've got a substantial part of the world covered.
We do, yeah. We're actually going to talk also about a substantial part of the world today. You know, it was auction season. It's winding down. We're recording this, you know, in mid-May. And there's really only one sale left for the sort of what we would call like the quote-unquote spring auctions, right? Like the April-May auctions. And that one's happening in Hong Kong this weekend. But we've got results from Hong Kong. We've got results from New York. We've got results from Geneva. And I thought it would be fun to bring the two of you guys on and kind of go through what we've learned this auction season. The auction world's been kind of weird since COVID hit, as everything else has been. So I thought we could kind of go through and see what we're learning about the state of the watch market today.
All right, let's do it.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Awesome. Well, I mean, to set things up, I mean, like I said, there have been sales in Hong Kong, Geneva, and New York. We're going to focus today mostly on Christie's, Sotheby's, and Phillips. There are other people doing watch sales. Bonhams is doing sales. Heritage is doing sales. Antiquorum is doing sales. But I think, you know, if we want to look at kind of the macro market trends, I think Sotheby's, Christie's, and Phillips gives us a nice picture without, you know, to make our lives a little easier, without the three of us having to pour through literally thousands and thousands of auction results, which I don't know about you guys. I don't have time for that.
Yeah, me neither. I think there's a hole in the market for someone to develop like an auction report, right? Someone just summarize auctions and report all of the data across the whole industry.
Don't get any ideas, Cole.
I mean, maybe some sort of website, you know, that has like a podcast attached to it.
Let's hold on that for now. But let's start with the top dogs here. Heading into auction season, there's always attention paid to like, oh, what's the big world record going to be this time? And Danny wrote a really great story, which we'll link to in the show notes, about the watch that everyone expected to be the star and turned out to be the star, at least financially, of this auction season, which is a Patek 2523 World Timer that sold at Phillips. This has a cloisonné enamel dial that depicts Europe and Asia. It's the quote-unquote Eurasia dial, as opposed to like a North America dial or something like that. And these watches are incredible. I mean, before we get into the numbers, I mean, Jack, I know you're a big fan of these watches. They are something special.
Oh, I mean, they're just unbelievably beautiful examples of absolutely classic golden age complicated watchmaking for Patek Philippe. They have unparalleled artistry. They have unparalleled history. I mean, you know, you look at one of them, you put it on your wrist and you're transported to a completely different era of, you know, personal elegance and style. And the prices, oy vey, the prices. I mean, you know, I kind of feel whenever I see a result like this nowadays, like an Egyptian peasant seeing the pyramids for the first time at like, you know, like 2000 BC, it's just like, well, that has no bearing on my personal life whatsoever or on the destiny of my family for the foreseeable future, but sure is big.
Yeah. These watches are stratospheric. They basically all sell for $1 million plus now. They've quietly kind of become like the Patek if you want something spendy. I don't know. Personally, I love travel watches.
Oh my gosh. Yes.
Yeah. I love travel watches in general. I know Cole feels the same way. Jack, I know you feel the same way. These to me, I love that they're travel watches and they have that romanticism, but also like from a timekeeping standpoint, you can read them like a time only watch, you know, like they're really practical in a funny way. And these cloisonné enamel dials, which are not, you know, normally my bag, like the more is more sort of thing is not normally my thing. These are absolutely stunning. Like if you're listening to this and you ever have a chance to see one of these at an auction preview, just go do it. Like it's worth the trip to the auction house or the preview alone just to see these things. They, you know, there's something about like 80-year-old handmade, hand-painted enamel that is, it is a legitimate work of art.
Every time I see one of these, this is probably a terrible idea, but every time I see one of these, I kind of think, how cool would it be? You know, the continents drift. How cool would it be to have a like, a Gondwana land world time watch that shows like the arrangement of the continents 300 million years ago, or like one that shows where they're going to be 50 million years in the future?
Well, they do take custom orders, Jack, just saying.
Yeah, I think Jack needs to call Thierry and get himself a Pangea world timer made. All right, so heading into auction season, this was the top lot at the major houses. It was estimated to sell for about $3.8 million. It seemed like a lot, but also totally reasonable, you know, if you comp it out against what else is sold previously. It ended up selling for almost double that. It ended up at a hair over 7 million Swiss francs. I think for me, the big takeaway here is old, beautiful Patek is still king. Like when it comes to auctions, nothing is going to outperform rare, beautiful, old, complicated watches from Patek Philippe. Does that seem reasonable to you guys?
I mean, do you think we've hit peak Daytona?
Yeah. I mean, I think overall, I mean, I think if you look at the kind of like quote unquote everyday Daytonas, yes. I mean, the next watch we'll talk about in a second is the next highest selling watch. And it is a Daytona, and it's not a Daytona like the ones you're talking about, Jack. It's not like a beautiful old 1960s Daytona.
Well, exactly.
But yeah, I think these, I don't know, at least if we're talking about the stuff that's on the covers of catalogs, the stuff that's going to get, you know, if you go to the results page and do like sort by result, high to low, I think if you look at those, if you look at those, you know, the first 6, 9, 12 watches that come up, more often than not, they are complicated mid-century Patek Philippe watches.
Yeah, no surprises there, right?
Yeah.
And we kind of know that they are actually rare items. So peak Daytona, you don't really know how many are out there, right? We actually don't know. There's no, you know, production numbers out there. We know for a fact that there are very few of these. So I think in terms of peak Daytona or not, I reckon that these will continue to climb and that this shouldn't be a crazy surprising result, because I think it's actually worth it. And I won't say a lot of these auction results are like, oh, there's a lot of value there. But when it comes to this, there really is.
Yeah. I mean, with auctions, the interesting thing, and this gets into the dynamics of auctions, right, is like for the value of something to escalate, all you need is two people. And for something this rare and this special, like I kind of believe it exists a little bit outside of market dynamics. Like there's not really a market for these. There's like 10 collectors. Mm-hmm. And at any given time, all you need is like two of them to be interested. So I think you're right, Cole. Like, I don't see this as a thing that 10 years from now, we're going to look back and be like, oh my God, somebody was paying $7 million for, Eurasia World Timer. I think we're going to look back and next time this watch comes up, it's going to be a $10 million watch. You know, I would not at all be surprised by that.
There's really no way of answering this question because we don't, you know, we obviously don't have any access to the data, but it makes me wonder how many clients there actually are for this kind of watch, you know, for a mid-century cloisonné enamel dial, super, super rare Patek Philippe that's going to go for between 3 and 7 million, depending on how many egos there are in the room and on the phones. It's like, I mean, there's an awful lot of, I mean, not an awful lot, but there's a significant number of high net worth people in the world who are interested in watches. And it's a bigger number now than it was 10 years ago, 20 years ago, and this watch would have traded for a fraction of what it we just saw it go for. And I think that there actually is a bigger pool.
Yeah, you might be right. I mean, I would love to go dig in. I'd have to go. I don't know if Philips has this data publicly available. I mean, I know they like kind of have to release it legally, but I don't know if it's easily accessible, I'll say. But I'd be curious to see how many different bidders bid on this watch at a serious level. Like not the person who raises their paddle for the first $1 million bid so that they can like have bid on it, but like I would love to see how many people were seriously competing once this watch got to $3 million, you know?
We could always file a freedom of information.
Not outside of America's borders, though.
Okay, so we take Paul Boutros out for lunch and serve him papers.
Yeah, exactly.
Or, hey, if you're one of them, hit us up in the comments. Let us know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, if you bid on this watch, like, seriously, let us know. I would love to know. All right, Jack, you already alluded, and we're going to come back and talk about more Patek later. Like, people don't need to worry. We're not done with Patek Philippe for this conversation. But you brought up Peak Daytona, and we've seen over the last number of years watches like really unique or interesting or rare manual wind 1960s and 70s Daytonas a la Paul Newman and others set crazy prices. We have the Unicorn, we have the Neanderthal, they all have nicknames, most of them given by Italian watch dealers. But this watch is weird. This is a really, really weird Daytona.
It's so weird.
It's so strange. And like, you know, spoiler alert, this is a $3.14 million watch. It sold for $24,375,000 Hong Kong dollars, which as of yesterday when I did the math was about $3.14 million. And this sold at Sotheby's in Hong Kong. It's a 16516 Daytona from 1998. It's platinum. It has a platinum bezel. And then it has a turquoise lacquer dial, which is insane. It's basically like a Stella dial kind of watch. They think it's unique. There aren't that many platinum Daytonas like this anyway. And I don't know. To me, like, this watch does not scream when you look at a picture of it, like, highly collectible and desirable.
I have to say, Stephen, like, I looked at this result and, you know, like, I first of all, I really love this watch. I mean, there's something about super, super eccentric Daytonas that I just find really, really appealing. And generally, if I like a Daytona and it's an auction listing, it means it's going to sell without reserve for under the low estimate. So I saw this result and I was like, you don't understand anything.
Yeah, I look at this result and like, I get it. It's a possibly unique Rolex and Rolex doesn't do unique pieces. So like from a collecting standpoint, I get it. I'm not surprised. I am surprised that this is like the most expensive Daytona we've seen in a very long time. That is kind of surprising to me.
I just want to point out that it sold for 3.14, which is a fantastic number. So that's nice to see.
Cole's breaking out the pie references here. I see what you're doing. So this watch, yeah. I mean, I think it does open up the question of like, have we reached peak Daytona? Have we reached peak Rolex? And I don't know. From my analysis, it seems like I do think the prices for the sort of rare stuff are coming down. Like Daytonas that would have been $90,000, $100,000, $150,000 two years ago are now probably more like $50,000, $70,000, and $90,000. But I think if you can find something that says Rolex on the dial that is unique or probably unique or like you can put some kind of like pretty limited quantity on it, I think you're going to get a crazy result still. I just don't think the market has tired or anytime soon is going to tire of rare Rolex examples.
Just as a watch to wear, I mean, you know, leaving aside the whole question of rarity and uniqueness, this is a watch that I would absolutely just love to wear on a regular basis. There's There's something so like freakishly engrossing about it.
Yeah, it's so strange. It is a deeply strange watch. And I love it even more thinking about the idea of this being like Jack Forrester's daily beater, you know? Throw this thing on like a NATO and just walk around with a platinum Daytona, a unique platinum Daytona with a turquoise dial on a NATO. I would co-sign that one, Jack.
What were you doing in 1998, Jack?
Oh, gosh, 1998. I think I was still practicing traditional Chinese medicine.
This would actually be the perfect watch for that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it would also come with a free mansplaining lecture from me on the origins of platinum in colliding neutron stars.
Perfect. The bidder did not anticipate that. Otherwise, I mean, if we're looking at records, otherwise, it's a pretty quiet season. And I'm not totally surprised by that. I mean, like, given what's going on in the world and the fact that some of these auctions had limited in-person attendance, sourcing property, I know, you know, talking to people at auction houses is way harder when you can't do it in person. People are kind of holding on to what they've got right now. So I'm not surprised by that. I also don't necessarily think that's a bad thing. But there were very few multi-million dollar watches this auction season. Like, you can count them on two hands from the major houses, and even things selling for over $500,000, relatively restrained. But that doesn't mean that we didn't see other areas go a little bananas. And the one that stood out most to me, and that I've literally been getting texts from people every day since the Philips sale in particular, FP Jarn. These watches are currently available, many of them. And like, yes, they're hard to get. They're limited in the same way that, like, you know, a Jumbo or a Nautilus or whatever, or a Daytona is hard to get. These watches are selling for like 3-4x retail, and they're watches that you can buy today. I don't know that I fully understand this result. Just to put one more number on this, Philips alone sold 11 FP Jarn watches, totaling $2 million in sales. For 11 FP Jarn watches. That seems to me like a major kind of like hockey stick moment for Jarn in the auction world.
I mean, I've always found auction results on FP Jarn watches really, really unpredictable. It seems very difficult to make generalizations about them just because, I don't know, I think collectors kind of perceive each watch as sort of having its own personality, and depending on the provenance, depending on when it was made, depending on,
sure,
you know, at what point in Francois Paul's career the watch was made, you can have, you know, sort of drastically different emotional reactions. Yeah, you got me.
Yeah, I mean, in particular, two kind of areas stood out to me. One are the simple watches, like, you know, Chronomet Souverain or the Chronomet Blue. I mean, a blue sold for 94,500 Swiss francs. That's what, like a $23,000 watch at retail? That's no joke. And like, granted, you can't get one at retail if you're not an existing client. So like, I get it. If you want one, this is kind of what you have to pay to get it. That stood out to me, that in the CS, and then the Resonance results. It's really, I know we're all big fans of that watch, and the version that came out last year is technically improved. I would argue aesthetically diminished, maybe, in my taste. And I think some of the frenzy for the old Resonance might be that the new one is now like very different. And I think some people are kind of thinking like, I kind of regret not getting one before they changed it. Because those results are now over 150, up to almost 300,000 US for a Resonance, which is like, it's a great watch, but like that is serious money.
It's a lot of money. Yeah, I don't particularly know what to make of that either, except, you know, again, to sort of say people sort of want what they want, and they are, this kind of goes back to that platinum Rolex that we were talking about. You know, you see something, if it's something you want and you can afford it, and you're going to get it whichever way you can. You're gonna go through whatever channels you have to. And if you can't get it through the boutique, you can't get it through regular retail channels, you can only get it at auction, and you don't really care about whether or not you're paying two or three times retail, or if you want an earlier version that's you know, more aesthetically appealing, and you're really, really sorry that you didn't get one when you could, you know, however many years ago it was out, then, you know, you just do what you have to do. I think that it speaks to the sort of degree of disposable income that people are increasingly willing to throw at, I think, collecting in general, certainly during the pandemic, and watches in particular.
I'm just glad that, or more so, there's a reason why it's a fantasy draft and not a real draft that I picked this watch in.
Yeah, true story. I mean, Cole, that actually brings us to an interesting point. So you wrote up ahead of the auctions about another brand that I don't, you know, when I think of auctions, right, like, Yes, FP Journe tourbillons, specifically the tourbillons, and even more specifically the subscription tourbillons, the really early ones that Francois Paul made mainly himself that are numbered. Those are truly, truly historic special watches. Those I get, but I don't typically think of Journe when I think of the auctions. It's not the first brand that comes to mind. Another one that doesn't come to mind really at all is Grand Seiko. And you wrote about a couple of Grand Seikos that came up at the different auction houses. And I wonder if you can kind of give us what you were thinking heading into the sales and then how the results either like confirmed or challenged your ideas.
So I think a good indicator, and this is true. So I guess to start off with, I will say that covering auctions, the takeaway is you don't know anything. Like anything goes, right? Nothing is really predictable, and there's always another level, and there's something that you haven't considered that affects these results. However, with that being said, when it comes to Grand Seiko, I mean, if you paid attention the last year and a half, I would say, kind of on whatever medium you go to for watch stuff, the chatter about Grand Seiko was there. All the little clues were there. You know, all of a sudden, more and more people are into it. All of a sudden, vintage. In fact, I even think you picked one up, didn't you, Stephen? Recently.
I did. I mean, it's not so recent anymore, but yeah, about 18 months ago, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So that's a little bit beyond when, but I would say the chatter on all these watch platforms about Grand Seiko grew a tremendous amount in the past year. Is it a surprise? Yes, it is actually a surprise for sure that they all went for above their estimates. But here's the other thing. I mean, at some point, people need something new. There is either a substitution effect at work, just it's new and exciting. You know, the spotlight moves back and forth over the whole landscape of all watches from every country, France, Switzerland, England, now Japan. So am I surprised? Not really. But like when you see the result in front of you, you're like, huh, interesting. Wow, Grand Seiko. All right.
Yeah. The ones that make the most sense to me and that I'm actually glad are finally getting their moment in the sun. I mean, for the most part, I like that they're not overhyped because it means I can still afford them. I mean, I'll be honest, the SBGW 033 result at Sotheby's, where that watch sold for almost $10,000, kind of bummed. Really was hoping to buy one of those. Really was hoping to not pay $9,500 for it. So we'll see if anybody has one and wants to sell it to me for less, you know where to find me. But the VFAs, which I know are watches I've had many conversations with Jack about over the years, are, I think, some of the like most unsung watches in the history of watchmaking. These are some of the finest chronometer. If you don't know what they are, a VFA stands for very fine adjusted. These are the watches that basically they're actual observatory chronometer competition movements cased up as wristwatches. They're cased up in these kind of larger grammar of design cases so that they can be sturdier and, you know, be less affected by shocks. These are some of the finest chronometer wristwatches made in the 20th century. And until recently, like, people didn't really know what they were. You could buy them for, you know, $8,000, $10,000 for a really nice one. Philips sold a pretty nice example of a 61 GS VFA, and it got 44,000 Swiss francs, 44,100 to be exact. And like, that actually makes me happy. I'm glad that these watches are now finally like on people's radar and getting attention. They're incredible.
I mean, they certainly deserve it.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, Jack, I don't know what your thoughts are, but like, do you think that Grand Seiko and specifically these kinds of watches, like the really idiosyncratic, unique, rare Grand Seikos, do you think we're going to see these kind of take off, or do you think they're going to maintain kind of their like niche status?
You know, I actually think they're going to take off. I think the pool of collectors is larger every day. I think that it's more discerning every day. I mean, you know, the funny thing is when I first started writing about watches, it took a long time to acquire any knowledge, to acquire any information. If you wanted to track what was going on at auctions, you had to go in person. You had to collect auction catalogs. You had to talk to people. You had to have telephone conversations. And, you know, nowadays it's actually possible.
Yuck, telephone conversations.
I know, right? But, you know, nowadays it's possible for people to become acclimated to what's hot and what's not really, really, really quickly. And you can become, I mean, I'm not necessarily saying you can become a general watch expert you know, in 6 months, I think that there's a learning curve. And I think to a certain extent, you can't speed it up if you want to become a good sort of generalist watch expert with a solid grasp of what's going on in the markets as well. That's really tough. Usually it's one or the other. But I do think that the market is evolving very, very quickly. You know, I mean, it's like there's a, you know, sort of a social engineer with his thumb pressed hard on the fast forward evolution button. And people are going to, they're going to gravitate towards known quantities, but the known quantities have escalated well out of most people's reach. And because they are known quantities, you know, there's a certain ubiquity to the sort of like classics that hit high numbers at auctions. It's like, there's no surprise there. And there's perhaps interest in collecting these things obviously if you can afford them and if you're interested, but I think that the thrill of discovering something when it's on the rise is one that cannot be duplicated by, you know, like collecting vintage Submariners at this point. You know, there really isn't a sense of discovery. There's a sense of getting, you know, possibly something that's going to increase in value, something that's interesting to collect in its own rights. But like, you know, discovering collecting vintage Grand Seiko, discovering collecting VFAs, I mean, it's an undiscovered country for a lot of collectors. And I think that there's a lot of potential interest that could really, really explode in that category.
Yeah.
Also, I mean, Grand Seiko has been pouring a ton of money, investing a lot of money into making Grand Seiko a thing, raising awareness around the brand. So
yeah,
it's not really a huge surprise that the vintage models are more familiar to people now as well.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I mean, if we want to talk Usual Suspects, let's go that direction for a minute, kind of the opposite of the VFA. I think we touched on it earlier, but like, the Usual Suspects are doing just fine. I think a lot of people have asked, I know I've gotten the question, I'm sure both of you have as well, over the last year or so, is like, oh, what did COVID do to the watch market? Has it, you know, ruined it? Are the prices terrible? And it's like, every watch dealer I talk to seems to be doing pretty darn well right now. And I think these public results would bear that out. Like, it's, you know, anecdotes are one thing, this is data. And if you look at the Usual Suspects, like Nautilus prices, still crazy. You know, after that Patek World Timer, the next four top results in that sale, four variations on the Patek Philippe 2499. Like, there might be no watch that I associate more with kind of like high-end auction results than the 2499. Philips had one of each series. They sold from anywhere from, 2.45 million at the high end, and then the least, quote-unquote, least desirable. I can't believe I'm saying that about a 2499, but sold for a little bit under half a million Swiss francs. So, like, those are strong results. They're not the most interesting results, but like, they tell us that the market part of this, and same thing with Daytonas and Submariners, you know, rare subs, mill subs, Explorer dial subs, those kinds of things. They tell us that the market is healthy, that like the outliers are doing interesting things, but the sort of core of the market, the stuff that, you know, when Philips is putting together a sale and knows they have to hit a certain number, this is the stuff that like they know is going to sell, you know? That stuff's doing well, and that's, I think, good, because that foundation then is what you can build the weird fun stuff on top of. If the core of the market isn't healthy, nobody's going to go out on a limb and spend, you know, millions of dollars on a strange cloisonne enamel watch. Nobody's going to venture 50 grand for a Grand Seiko that most collectors have never heard of, you know? But if the 2499s and the mill subs are doing well and the Nautilus is doing well, like, okay, maybe people feel like things are healthy, and that provides a jumping off point. I'll also just quickly say I was heartened to see, you know, some nice Vacherons and some nice Longas at the tops of all the catalogs. Basically, everybody had those things. It's nice to see. I know I'm preaching to the choir here, but like, high-end watchmaking is not just Patek Philippe, AP, and then some outliers. It's a bigger fraternity than that, and it's nice to see those folks represented. I didn't hate seeing some Hodinkee limited editions sell above their retail prices. Our Grand Seiko, Laurent Ferrier, the Tag Skipper, which continues to be popular. That was nice to see. Just makes me happy. You know, I know many of our colleagues poured a lot of time and energy into making those watches, so it makes me happy to see that customers still want them and are excited to.
MB&F?
Yeah, there was an MB&F as well, which I love that watch. Man, I wish I had gotten that watch. Oof. Brown dial steel MB&F.
Oof. So good.
But yeah, it's interesting. I'm personally coming out of this auction season just so excited for the fall auction season and the idea that like I might get to be in Geneva for it. I mean, Jack and I have covered the auctions together many, many times. Cole, I have not had the pleasure of hanging out with you in an auction room, but I absolutely love it. And I love the people. And I had major FOMO seeing some of my friends from the States make the trip over. And I am just so damn excited in November to be in Geneva, to be in the room, to hear the chit chat. It's going to be super fun. And I really honestly can't wait for it. And I hope that things stay trending in the direction they're trending so that, you know, yeah. Jack, we can go eat a way too expensive, way too mediocre meal somewhere and then go bust our asses in the auction room.
I mean, listen, it's fine to watch the big game on television, but there's nothing like being in the stadium.
It's true. It's very true. All right, I got two things I want to do here. One, we're going to do a quick look ahead. You know, we're recording this at the end of the week prior to when people will be hearing this. There is one auction left. It's Christie's in Hong Kong, and probably, I would guess, the biggest watch of the auction season overall, if not the biggest in terms of price, maybe the one that's like the most fascinating, is still to be sold as of us recording this. And that is a Senzaluna 3448 from Patek Philippe. We will link in the show notes to Cara's incredible story from years ago. I've heard from many people that this story like legitimately changed the market on these watches. The Senzaluna is basically, it's a 3448 perpetual calendar, but instead of a moon phase display, it has a leap year indicator, hence Senzaluna without moon. This is the only one 100%, no question, known to have come out of Patek Philippe this way. It was a gift from Patek Philippe to Alan Bamberry, who was their head of sales for many years. It was a gift from Henry and Philippe Stern. The watch is from the mid-70s. It's beautiful. It's weird. The estimate is in the millions of dollars. I think it's 3.5 to 5 million is the estimate. This is a super weird, wild one. And I don't know, do either of you have any thoughts of what we should expect or be looking for or what you're interested in with the sale of this watch?
I mean, I think that it's probably, I mean, obviously this is going to go for a lot of money. I think it's going to go for well over estimate. And beyond that, I think that it's a guessing game.
Do we think Patek Philippe's bidding on this watch?
I mean, something like this, it seems like a given.
You got to imagine this ends up in the Patek Museum, right?
Yeah, where we can all enjoy it.
Exactly. I like that. We'll go visit it, Jack. We'll go say hi. Maybe they'll be very nice and take it out of the case and let us try it on.
Yeah,
they're definitely not going
to
do that.
Maybe not. That's what we should do the next time we go to Geneva. We should go to the Patek Museum and ask to try stuff on.
Should we record it, like secret recording of this?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's video.
I love this.
Man.
We'll get Gray on that right away. We're going to talk about a couple other things here, but for those interested in this watch, stick around after this conversation. John Buse and I are going to be watching the auction. It'll be Saturday morning, our time. We're going to be watching, and then we're going to hop on and record a little bit of a postmortem on this watch and one or two other things at the Christie sale. So after Jack, Cole, and I are done, stay tuned. You're going to hear a little bit more and you'll get the kind of final say on this watch. We'll know what happened. We can't predict the future here today, but through the magic of radio, you'll know by the time this airs. The last thing I wanted to ask you guys with to close quickly is looking ahead at the auction world and kind of taking out of this season, what did well, what kind of emerged, what's new, what's different. If there was a brand or a type of watch that you think people should be paying attention to over the next 6 months leading up to the November sales and kind of keep an eye out for, what would you personally be looking at? Maybe we'll start with Cole and then Jack, and then I'll bring up the rear here.
Yeah, what should you look at? I would say Ennekar is very interesting to look at because for the first time, more are appearing, and they appear very infrequently in this circuit, and that's interesting. So just, that's one to keep an eye on. Ennekar, interesting, you know? Then I would say King Seiko. If we're seeing Grand Seiko rise like this, and this is just the beginning, then, all right, it's time to look at King Seiko too. And then, yeah, vintage tool watches that are kind of interesting, like vintage Breitling. And why I say this is because after doing that week on the wrist with the AVI 765 and seeing how well Breitling has reissued some of their greatest hits, that raises awareness around the vintage version of those examples. And naturally, you know, more awareness, higher prices. So yeah, I would look at those three: Ennekar, King Seiko, vintage Breitling. Keep an eye on them.
You know, I think those are three really fantastic picks. Anacart to me is really interesting because it's so hard to find them in really, really good condition. But you know, when you see one in good condition, they're incredibly beautiful. I passed on it. This is many, many years ago, but there was a barber shop near the office where I used to work that also sold used watches on the side, and they had an absolutely mint Sherpagraph in the window for $250. And I have been kicking myself for not buying it for many, many years. But they're really, really charming watches. And I agree with you on King Seiko as well. You know, Stephen, I took what you said in kind of a prescriptive way, you know, sort of like, what should people, if they weren't such idiots, actually actually be spending money on? And, you know, this is not an inexpensive watch at all, so maybe it's a bad example. But coming up at the Philips Hong Kong, there's this pocket watch. It is lot 2506, the Patek Philippe Radovsky Grand Complication. And it's an amazing piece on a number of levels. I mean, a Grand Complication pocket watch from Patek is never anything to sneeze at, but it's got a Julian and Gregorian perpetual calendar. And I cannot remember seeing that particular complication before. So it's a really interesting slice of history as well. I would like to see a slightly more direct relationship between actual horological merit and the price paid for watches. And I've been wishing that for many years, and I should probably stop. Because that's not, I mean, it's just not how collecting works. You know, I mean, I was researching something else over the weekend and I found out that a rare vintage, quote unquote, Pokemon card from the late 1990s just went for $500,000 at auction. $500,000 for a piece of pasteboard. So clearly there's the object and there's the aura that kind of accumulates around the object. But I feel like we're seeing price-wise a lot of vintage Pokemon card style results. I just wish people would think a little bit more about what a watch represents in terms of the actual craft that went into it and what it represents horologically. And I can keep right on wishing.
Yeah, it's true. That is one interesting point that I guess I'll just add a little something here is, you know, I only started even paying attention to auctions once I joined Hodinkee. Prior to that, really, no, never. But I've learned to sort of decouple collecting watches and appreciating watches from observing and thinking about auctions. I almost look at it as a exercise in economics rather than appreciating craftsmanship and watches. And
yeah,
that's a hard thing to decouple. But once you do, I think each one becomes more enjoyable.
All right, I'll give it one recommendation. Honestly, I think you guys did a great job there. But one I'm going to say is vintage Breguet. Mid-century Breguet is super underappreciated, in my opinion. Whether it's the Empire watches, which I think can go toe-to-toe with any mid-century watch from Patek or Vacheron or AP. Like, if you want beautiful time-only or time-and-date watches, they're much more classical in terms of their styling and much more sort of like idiosyncratic. They're stunning, and they were made in tiny quantities, and they're starting to pop up more frequently. There are great chronographs, both sporty chronographs and dress chronographs. So there were some, if you go through the recent spat of Christie's, Sotheby's, and Phillips sales, which we'll have links to the catalogs in the show notes, the online catalogs, go look. There are some in there, and I think we're going to keep seeing more and more of them. And I know some pretty savvy collectors who are paying attention to them and have been for a couple of years now. And I think that's a thing we're going to continue to see more of. So vintage Breguet, mid-century Breguet. All right, guys. Well, I think that does it for us for the looking back part. And now we've just got to all wait and see what's going to happen on Saturday morning with the Banbury. And listeners, stick around. Right after this, you're going to hear my conversation with John Buse recapping that sale. So thanks so much for joining me, guys. Really appreciate it. And here's to doing November in Geneva, my friends.
Your mouth to God's ears. Thanks, Stephen.
Amen.
Awesome. Thanks, guys. Hey, John, how's it going?
Hey, how's it going, man?
Good. Talking auctions on a Saturday morning, right?
Auctions on a Saturday. Let's do it.
For everybody listening, you've just heard my conversation probably with Jack and Cole about most of the spring auctions, but one was kind of late-breaking news. It happened in Hong Kong just like literally a couple hours before John and I are having this conversation. This is the last auction of spring. It was at Christie's in Hong Kong, and it was kind of an unusual sale. Do you want to just give us a little bit of background on this, since I know you covered it on the site?
Yeah, I mean, it was it was a little bit of an unusual sale. For one thing, it was an evening sale. I think they billed it as like a white glove kind of sale, just 18 kind of primo lots covering, you know, a range of things, but, you know, mainly mid-century paddock and, like, you know, beautiful kind of enamel work, on, I don't know, just like horological objects, we'll say. So I'd say that the lots can be divided into those two main categories.
Yeah. I mean, we've got like beautiful classic, what like everybody would think of as like kind of the golden age of Patek Philippe. And then a whole bunch of like strange, like 18th and 19th century enamel pocket watches and clocks and like this weird automaton gun thing with a flower that comes out of the end and a bird that chimes. It's like,
it sprays perfume too.
Oh, it sprays perfume?
I believe so, right? That's like,
oh man,
does.
I missed that. That's awesome. I was going to say the way I would describe these kinds of watches, these are Jack things, right? You know?
For sure. Yeah. 100%.
But yeah, the Patek stuff is really what I wanted to make sure to talk to you about, because there were a few lots worth noting. There was an incredible Grand Complication pocket watch. There was a trio of World Timers, which did strong results. I mean, a platinum 1415 at the equivalent of just shy of 1.9 million US. There was a yellow gold 1415 with an enamel dial that did a little over 2 million US. And a really cool 2523 on a bracelet, like a mesh bracelet that, I don't know about you, but I would absolutely love to wear this watch. Mm-hmm. That also did a little over 2 million. So like, you know, next to the Eurasia World Timer, like, okay, not quite as record setting, but like strong results for beautiful watches. But the watch we really, I know, all had our eyes on was the Bamberry 3448 Senzaluna. Do you want to, again, since you covered it, just give us a quick kind of overview of what this watch is before we get into the results?
Sure. So this is kind of like, you know, so the Senzaluna is a well-known and a watch that's certainly not without controversy. Kara wrote, you know, kind of like the story on the Senzaluna as a category when she did some, you know, investigative journalism on the topic. And, you know, but there is one watch of the seven known Senzalunas. There is one of them that is, you know, kind of like unimpeachable. And it's this Alan Banbury owned example that was gifted. You know, he is the former retail director of Patek Philippe. He is the person who assisted Philippe Stern in putting together the private collection that, you know, that we know is like the Patek Philippe Museum collection. So a very important person from the company, and he was recognized, I believe, on the 10th anniversary of his employment at the company by the Sterns with the gift of this, you know, unique 3448. Where instead of a moon phase indicator on the perpetual calendar, it has the leap year. And so this is 100% correct Senzaluna, owned by Alan Banbury. So it's got like internal Patek Philippe provenance, and you know, of something that's incredibly rare, it stands out, you know, even among the other seven.
Yeah, and the other Senzalunas, you know, so the 3448 has the moon phase at 6 o'clock, you know, inside the date display, and this watch has the leap year indicator instead of the moon phase. The other Senzalunas just have the moon phase covered up. There's no additional leap year indicator. So it's not only is the provenance unimpeachable, but like you said, the watch itself is also unique. 3448s are a strong watch when it comes to vintage Patek Philippe. I mean, they can fetch anywhere from, I mean, on the low end, maybe $150,000 to $200,000 US, mm-hmm. If it's an okay example at auction. We see them sell for, you know, many, two, three times that pretty regularly. Like, they can get up to $500,000, $600,000, $700,000, not, you know, with too much fanfare. And the record heading into today, Carr also mentioned in that story, which we will have linked up in the show notes, was for a quote unquote standard 3448, not a Senzaluna, but it was double signed by Frecciaro, the famous retailer. And that sold in 2011. It pulled just north of $2 million. And nothing's really come very close to that since, even a handful of Senzaluna results, you know, kind of before that in the early 2000s, when a bunch of these traded hands. It is important to note, the Banbury watch, this is not the first time it's come up for sale. The watch sold at Sotheby's in 2008. It sold for about $1.84 million. And today, it hammered for $29,050,000 Hong Kong dollars, which by my math is $3.74 million U.S. So we kind of buried the lead here. We're a couple minutes into this. $3.74 million result on the Banbury Senza Luna. What's your first take here? Like, what's that result mean to you, John?
Well, I mean, I think just in terms of, like, you know, numerically, it's just about double what it sold for last time it sold publicly. So it's a very strong result. And, you know, I mean, but I'm not terribly surprised. I mean, when you think about the fact that this is a watch that was worn by an executive, you know, probably one of the most important executives in the last 50 years at Patek Philippe, whose last name is not Stern, you know, inside the walls of the manufacturer for so many years, the fact that it's unique, in the fact that it's, you know, the only Senza Luna that is, you know, 100%, we just know that it's 100% correct because it has all the boxes have been ticked. So super cool watch, strong result. And I think it, you know, it really, but it didn't come close to the high estimate. You know, the high estimate for this sale was 40 million Hong Kong dollars. So this, you know, falls quite well short of the high estimate, but still sets a record for the reference overall.
Yeah, I think you bring up a good point, which is that, like, this is obviously no result to scoff at, but I'll admit I was a little surprised. I thought this would blow the high estimate away. I thought this was going to be a $7-9 million watch.
Yeah, I agree. I thought that this watch had a chance to become the most expensive wristwatch to sell in Asia, displacing the world time from late 2019. But it didn't quite get there.
Yeah, I mean, you brought up a lot of good points. I mean, it's a unique watch. It comes from inside Patek Philippe. It's kind of a part of the history of the company. It's a reference that's, like, pretty wearable. Like, people wear 3448s, 3450s. They look great. They're kind of oversized for modern, you know, they have this bezel that makes them appear a little bigger. They're great watches to wear. I'm a little surprised. I almost wonder if, you know, I've mentioned this before, but, like, I got to imagine Patek Philippe was bidding on this. I mean, Alan Banbury helped put the Patek Museum together. You got to imagine that Thierry and Philippe Stern want this watch in the museum. And I almost wonder if there was a sort of, like, acknowledgement of that, and if people kind of, like, let them have it for less so that it could end up in the museum. We'll see. We'll see if it ended up there. We don't know yet. Again, the hammer fell, like, 2 hours, 3 hours before we're recording this. And with no, you know, with none of us live in the room, it's a little hard to tell, but it's a strong result. It's not a result that blows me away. And I'm a little shocked that this isn't even the most expensive watch of this auction season. I kind of, like, want to know more. I want to go, you know, wait, and when the dust settles, talk to a few people and see if maybe there's something that was going on that nobody knew about ahead of the sale. And even in the hours immediately after, because it feels like, I don't know, if we look at vintage Patek Philippe and what's been happening and with prices, you know, pretty consistently there being watches in the $3-8 million range, I'm a little shocked this isn't joining that pantheon.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. And what's interesting is that in this same auction, in the same, you know, fairly tight curation of 18 lots, there's another watch that we already talked about, that Platinum World Time, used to be the most expensive watch in the world, you know?
Right. That's true. I had actually forgotten that. You're totally right.
Right. Back in the early 2000s, that was, for a time, the most expensive wristwatch. So, but it fell, and I think it was around $6 million when it held that. And so the price it achieved here falls well short of its former price. And now we have the Banbury, as the most expensive lot from the, from this auction here in Hong Kong.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, like, people will, again, have just heard my discussion with Colin Jack, and kind of our assessment was that, like, auction results are strong, both at the high end and kind of the more consumer level. You know, looks like the market's healthy. We're setting records. Certain brands are creeping up. Vintage Rolex, vintage Patek, they're staying strong. These results, this was supposed to be like, you know, 18 kind of like show-stopping lots. And I would say like the prices are good, but not great. Like they're right. They're fine. This is one where like I thought you and I would have a kind of like firm answer heading into this recording. I thought we'd be able to tell people like this is the story. I'm a little curious. These results to me feel like maybe there's something else going on that, you know, come Monday morning, we're going to have to call some folks in Switzerland and some folks in Italy and some folks in Hong Kong and try to kind of puzzle piece this one together.
I think you're right.
Thanks for taking the time to do this, man. Saturday morning. We'll have to follow this up. I think you and I are going to have some work to do on Monday morning, but let's go enjoy our weekend. And yeah, this is another auction season in the books.
Yep. Thanks, man.